The university is pleased to present this online program entitled Improving Equity with the Right Tools. We are very pleased to welcome all of you. I'd like to draw your attention to the links box on the left side of your screen. To download a PDF of the slides or any other item, simply click on the link there and a separate window will open. The webinar evaluation link is also in this area. You must be logged in to ICMA University to access the survey from here, but you can also find it on your dashboard after today's program by clicking on the program title. It is my pleasure to introduce our speakers, Amy Kane, Roberto Montoya, Siri Russell, and Manisha Paudel. Roberto Montoya is the West Region Manager for the Government Alliance on Race and Equity, called GARE, and he brings nearly 20 years of corporate, higher education, and governmental experience to the organization. Before joining this team, Roberto worked for the City and County of Denver as the Manager of Diversity and Engagement at the Denver International Airport. He is also the founder and CEO of the Proximity Group, a diversity and equity consulting firm that focuses on the intersection of theory, practice, and place. Manisha Paudel is the equity coordinator for the City of Des Moines, Iowa, where she arrived after serving in various other local governments and positions in Iowa and Washington. A trained facilitator in areas including intercultural competency and fair and impartial policing, she serves as the national co-chair for GARE and sits on her county's Continuum of Care board that works to reduce and eliminate homelessness. As the City of Boulder's Equity Program Manager, Amy Kane is a trusted, compassionate, and collaborative equity accomplice dedicated to addressing institutional racism and optimizing outcomes for those who experience the most marginalization. She's committed to advancing racial equity and improving outcomes for people by investing in their power through education, outreach, and data-driven strategic policy and program design. People are what's most important to Amy, and she passionately believes none of us should have to go it alone. Siri Russell is the inaugural director of the Office of Equity and Inclusion for Albemarle County, Virginia. In this role, Siri partners with other local government departments, community organizations, and individuals to promote an inclusive community and equitable access to public services by creating alignment between the principles of equity and inclusion and the operations of the organization. We're happy to have all of you here with us today, and Roberto, I'll turn it over to you to get us started.
Thank you so much. It's truly an honor to be with you all here today. So buenas tardes or buenos dias, depending on where you're at. And to be talking about improving equity with the right tools. Again, my name is Roberto Montoya. I'm the GARE West Regional Manager, and my preferred pronouns are he, him, and ello. And I'm coming to you from Denver, Colorado, the ancestral lands of the Cheyenne, Arapaho, and Ute people. And I am descendant of the Pueblo Indians of New Mexico. And as we're talking about tools today, I'm going to model a tool as one way to begin to normalize talking about race. And it comes out of one of the areas of my research, which focuses on narrative, counter-narrative, and in this example, testimonio. So come with me as I introduce myself in a bit of a different way. As I sit on this bench, I cannot help but think of all the experiences I've had at this park, in this housing project community, and in this barrio. Delamar, even saying the names invoke palpable memories of childhood. Delamar, a nondescript park tucked between 4th and 2nd Street, located in the North Valley of Albuquerque, New Mexico, was and is nothing special. Just another park waiting for the trickle-down that was promised by Reaganomics. It's been 32 years since I've been back, and as I stroll through this park, a park that once felt endless, I feel like a fantasma, a ghost, a remnant of days gone by. I wonder, does she even remember me? As my feet return to touch this hallowed grass, does she perk up with that feeling of faded recognition, that perplexing internal questioning when you ask yourself, I think I know that dude. I may have grown up with him. He looks really familiar. Or has the countless waterings, mowings, and fertilizing erased any memory of my time spent here? Surely the endless games of hide-and-go-seek, football, three-on-three, 21, and horse must have left a lasting mark. And I'm sure that for many at first sight, this park is ordinary at best, dilapidated and lacking any of the modern splendors that parks and playgrounds can boast of today. Yet for me, this park was a veritable wonderland of joy, exploration, development, freedom, and exposure. And as I sit here today, the sounds, the smells, and the surroundings have changed. Where's the music? How can this park even exist without the hi-hat beats of Nucleus, Slick Rick, Dougie Fresh, Boogie Down Productions, and Run DMC? Where are the lowriders, the breakdancers, the b-ballers, the veteranos and bachucos, and their Chuck Taylors mean-mugging everyone? Where's the life? Even the few kids who are playing here seem different, strangers in a land that once housed the mighty empire. And that's what we were, rulers of this park, a civilization of chamacos that reigned supreme, flourishing off the resources that this park yielded, the abundance seemed never-ending, and our desire to work the land where we ceased. It began as soon as cartoons ended and went well into the night. Streetlight roll be damned. Perdóname, mamá. Forgive me, mom. I heard you, but this park often rendered my ears useless. Where did it all go? As I look around, I can't help but wondering if it's me that's changed. Has my journey and my time away blinded me of the aforementioned experiences that have shaped the essence of who I am? Are those experiences of my childhood right in front of me and somehow I'm unable to see them any longer? Like the kids from the Polar Express, have my ability to hear that sleigh bell eroded? Damn that, times are different. I know it, or do I? Or have I become my pops, relegated to an elevated and nostalgic perception of times gone by? That aging bata who admonishes, things were better back in the day. Were they, or were they just simpler? That can't be true. We could barely afford to eat, keep our lights on, and to get around town. James Baldwin once wrote that anyone who's ever struggled with poverty knows how extremely expensive it is to be poor. And in hindsight, I think we knew we had it rough. Yet there was a simplicity that came along with this struggle. Simpler because so many of us who lived in these 26 freestanding four-apartment units that astonishingly continue to stand sentry around Delamar Park today shared in its reality, and we shared in the poverty. As I complete a full circle, I return to the park bench where I would hang out with, what's his name? I'm remiss that I cannot remember his name because this cat had such a profound impact on me. How can I not remember his name? I do, however, remember that he was an exceptional artist. He would make the most amazing sketches and drawings of fanciful heroes and heroines with special powers, weapons, and attributes. He was Dungeons and Dragons, Final Fantasy, role-playing, and Zelda before they were even created. And at this point in my life, I've never been exposed to fantasy as a genre. I've never heard of Tolkien, Bilbo, Frodo, or Gandalf. And in retrospect, I'm certain that the artist, as I will call him, had most certainly journeyed to Middle Earth. The artist wore a dingy black trench coat, had greasy blonde hair that hung to his shoulders, and boots that looked as if he was taking a break from combat tours. Yet despite his appearance, he was not unkindly, scary, or unapproachable. He was the first white dude that I remember hanging out with, and to that point, I hadn't realized just how few Weddos lived in our neighborhood. Nevertheless, he was always very gregarious and inquisitive. He would share his art and ask our opinions about his work, his ideas, and ways to improve his characters. He would disappear for weeks at a time and come back with new sketches. He'd even model characters after some of us kids at the park. He would say, this one's like you, short, strong, and fast, despite his size. And although he never played sports with us, he was perceptive, and his sketches and our likeness were masterful. It made me feel like I was one of the heroes on his pages of the sketchbook and that I could take on any forward villain. And for my sister and I, he ignited a lifelong love affair with everything fantasy. He was the reason that I searched in the mess that I called a closet for the Chronicles of Narnia book set that my grandparents gave me one Christmas. I was livid when I opened that gift, not only because it was books, and at the time I was not a reader and books are the ultimate Christmas buzzkill, but also because the box that it was wrapped in looked exactly like the Nintendo game system that I so desperately wanted that year. However, after reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, my imagination was never the same. To this day, I still reach towards the back of any closet, hoping that my fingers feel that marvelous thing of cold air and that I can walk through and see that magnificent lamppost. Simply stated, the artist and his imagination enabled me to find mine. Prior to losing myself in his made-up world on this park bench, all I wanted to do was play sports. Now I wanted to consume everything fantasy, even in book form. He gave us some of his sketches, and sadly, my sister and I lost them after the many moves after leaving Delamar as we entered the crushing carousel that is Section 8 housing. I have no doubt, or shall I say I hope, that the artist works for some software or gaming company creating role-playing games, and I often fantasize that I play one of his games and that one of the characters is actually me based upon his time at this park on this bench. Regardless, his impact on me was as important as anyone I can remember, and I think of him often. Maya Angelou once said that if one is lucky, a solitary fantasy can totally transform 1 million realities. His art, his gift, and his generosity has enabled me to transform myself to countless realities, which I now know helps me deal with mine own. Thank you so much for allowing me to share this testimonial as a way to animate my racialized experience. It goes beyond simply stating that I grew up in Albuquerque. But for you, I want to convey that this is not just work for me, but it's a part of my epistemology. It's a part of my ways of knowing. And so I come to this work with a deep sense of humility and grace. I do work for the Government Alliance on Race and Equity, and we work as part of a larger organization called Race Forward. And Race Forward is looking to catalyze a movement to build for racial justice. And we do this by partnering and working with communities, organizations, sectors to build and advance racial justice in our policies, practices, procedures within institutions and within culture. Our work includes Colorline, which is our media portion of the company, our Facing Race Conference, which is coming up here soon, and I just put in the link, the link to Facing Race, the Government Alliance on Race and Equity as well, and then also looking that we do research, we do policy, we're looking at movement and capacity building, and we do narrative arts and culture. With the Government Alliance on Race and Equity, we are a national network of government working to achieve racial equity and to advance opportunities for all. We are 210 members growing. We have 15 state agencies. We have 10-plus regional agencies. And essentially, we are looking for praxis. How do we put theory into action? You know, and Americans deeply desire thoughtful and constructive conversations about race. You know, communities are choosing to work together to devise innovative solutions to achieve racial equity. And it's been my experience in 20-plus years of doing this work. When you are doing deep and meaningful equity work, you will meet the most fantastic resistance. So we must be prepared for that. But why does government matter? Right? Why do we look to government? Right? It's one of the only institutions to scale and to temper the market, right? We respond to the federal government. It's the largest employer of people of color, right? We look to embed infrastructure and resources to sustain racial equity, right? And let's talk about it. When we see anti-government attacks, that a lot of times they are racialized, right? And the public sector shapes narrative locally and nationally. Essentially, we cannot have a strong multiracial democracy without racial justice. And we cannot have racial justice without a strong multiracial democracy. And so some of the strategies that we have at GARE is we're a membership network of jurisdictions, and we're looking to work together, right? We're expanding pathways for new jurisdictions who are beginning racial equity work. And a lot of jurisdictions are in different areas along the spectrum of doing this work, and we recognize that. Right, and we support and build local and regional collaborations that are focusing on racial equity. Here's a quick map of our network, and we are growing tremendously. I started with GARE in March. When I started, we had about 94 members. As of yesterday, we had 294. So there is movement, and a new national consensus is building up from communities across the country who believe that addressing racism and inequality is what our country needs to survive, to survive and to thrive. But make no mistake, there's a concerted effort from the highest offices in the land to prevent people from talking and working together to overcome racism and inequality. But at the end of the day, we cannot wish away racism. We have to work it away, and it will take all of us to do that. But in order to do that, we need to be talking about the role of government, as government has a vital role in advancing racial equity and in governing and providing services in an equitable manner. So let's dig into really quickly why and how we do that. And let's do this by not being ahistorical, right? Let's talk about some of the values and realities that we have seen in the past. How about this one? All men are created equal. And where does that come from? Many of you know that's from the U.S. Constitution in 1776. All men are created equal was revolutionary at the time that the words were used. But at the time that Jefferson spoke these words, who did they apply to? Not everyone, unfortunately. Only white male property owners, right? So it was a very specific term with a very limited application. With liberty and justice for all, where does that come from? From the Pledge of Allegiance. It was written in 1892 and adopted by Congress in 1954. And millions of school children recite this Pledge of Allegiance. I did it in New Mexico in both English and Spanish. And with liberty and justice for all is a direct attempt to inculcate a core value with young people that freedom and justice apply to all citizens. And yet, we need only take a look at the disproportionalities in sentencing in our criminal justice system to see that this is clearly not true. And then lastly, let's look at this one. Government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. And this is from the Gettysburg Address, which is a statement about who is served by government and a promise about who will benefit. All of us. This does not reflect the disparate outcomes we experience in education, healthcare access, life expectancy, infant mortality, employment, family wealth accumulation, and we can go on. So essentially, racial equity is not natural, and racial inequity is not random, right? Racial inequity is the result of creating societal barriers to reduce resources, and legal barriers to full protection in American life, prosperity, and civic society. So unlike what we've been told through our education system, it is not always equitable. So if we look at the history of government and race, it can be told in three phases, right? In the first phase, government was initially explicit in its racial oppression. Government passed and enforced laws that determined who could vote, who could be a citizen, who could own property, who was property, whose land was whose land could we simply take, who could marry whom, whose military service would be honored, and whose would not. Fortunately, we passed the 13th, 14th, and 15th constitutional amendments to end slavery, where all free slaves were entitled to equal protection under the laws of the U.S., and all black men could vote. And then we had the 19th Amendment, you know, around suffrage, where women could vote. And so these laws and policies implemented because government, you know, so we have to ask ourselves, were these laws and policies implemented because government woke up and just said, oops, my fault? No, this occurred because people came together in mass protests and in tactical coalitions to change the laws in our country. You know, but then government racism became implicit, right? Discrimination was made illegal, but race-neutral policies and practices repeated the patterns of exclusion and continued, unfortunately, to perpetuate inequity, right? So race neutrality has not worked. After making some progress, inequity is actually sometimes worse in some areas. So it's necessary to address and acknowledge race as a factor in creating inequity, and we want to make progress on reducing racial inequity. So I would argue now, even despite the national rhetoric, that we are in a new era where people in government are making efforts to transform it from the inside. Call it the GARE era network of government entities that apply a racial equity analysis in their work to create better outcomes for everyone. And all we have to do is look at the amount of people that are attending today. It gives me great hope and inspiration to be a part of this. Now, a lot of people ask, why do you lead with race? You know, I work for an organization called Race Forward, right? We believe that race inequities are deep and pervasive, and we just need to look at disaggregated data to validate that. But we know that racial anxiety is on the rise. It's often the one thing that people do not want to talk about. But we know that learning an institutional and structural approach can be used within other areas of marginalization, right? So for us, specificity matters. We're race explicit, but not race exclusive. And we always bring an intersectional analysis to this work. And for us, it is, you know, essentially looking at, again, these inequalities that we see within the U.S. And at GARE, we have a national best practice, right? Where we're looking to normalize conversations about race, to organize those folks who want to do something, and then begin to operationalize in those tools, using racial equity tools and develop strategies that are going to drive results. And then how do we begin to visualize a more just future? So one of the tools that I showed earlier in introducing myself is just begin to examine some of your earlier experiences with race. All of us were raised in a racialized way, Even if you identify as white, that's a racialized experience. And it's okay to go back and to look and start asking about the neighborhood you grew up with. Start thinking of, when was the first time that you had a teacher of a different race? When was the first time you had a teacher that shared your gender and race? You know, how were you treated differently in society? And you know, when did you first work in a community that was racially different from the one that you grew up with? So start thinking about this. Begin to normalize conversations about race, even within ourselves, which is very important. And for us, ultimately, race equity means closing the gap so that race does not predict one's success, while also improving outcomes for all. And to do this, we must target strategies to focus on improvements for those worse off. And that actually improves the conditions for everyone. It's something called targeted universalism, and it's the way that we come to this work. But we also must move beyond just services and focus on changing policies, institutions, and structures. So I'm going to leave you with this. One of my favorite scholars is a gentleman named Zeus Leonardo, who's out at Berkeley. He wrote this beautiful book called Race Frameworks. And he starts the book off and he says this: race thought and work is never easy. It's full of tension, it's ripe with contradictions, and needs all the help it can recruit. But most importantly, our analysis should be as complex as the topic itself. Let's do this complex work together. I'm so honored and excited to be a part of this conversation today, and I'm so excited to pass it over to Manisha, who's going to talk about some of the applied work that's being done by some amazing municipalities and the work that's happening in Des Moines. So I'll pass it over.
Thank you, Roberto. I'm so thankful to you for building such a powerful grounding space for us. So much gratitude to you. So as we talk to you about using tools to advance and promote racial equity, I'm really here to share about the process that we've adopted here in the city of Des Moines, Iowa. And we are still working on finalizing our very own equity toolkit. If you look around, if you just Google, you'll find a lot of toolkits that are out there. But what we found, effective was for us to really contextualize for our community, for our organization, and also the culture that we have here in the Midwest. So this is a picture of our internal equity core team. We're called Equitable Services Team. This team was established in January 2018 to really help City of Des Moines create a culture of equity within an organization as we begin to sort of unpack what are some of the inequities in our services, policies, and practices that continue to perpetuate, and what are some of the unintended and or intended consequences of our actions as city employees. And the intention here really is to serve all Des Moines residents with the recognition that there are pockets of our community, there are groups that have historically and currently being marginalized and minoritized. So how do we better understand as a group of city staff across all departments? So our team has 24 individuals and they represent all city departments. So one of the first things that we wanted to do as a team was to define equity. For us, it was important that we had a shared language. Creating and taking ownership of a shared language takes time, intentions, and compromise. We won't all have our way, and that's okay. And that process in itself was helpful for us to recognize what it takes to truly and authentically advance and promote equity. So for us, equity is a condition which deliberately, and note that the term deliberately is bolded, creates choices, access, and opportunities for all people to fulfill their basic needs, advance their well-being, and achieve their full potential. And we've adopted context of this language from across the country, thanks to our GARE staff and members and the network to really help us better understand what is commonly utilized language around equity and how can we adopt that for our own use. And so the first meeting that we had as a team, the Equitable Services team, we really wanted to make sure that all 24 members of the team understood what it meant to lead with equity, to advance equity as a local government, right? And not everybody is on the same page in terms of understanding. So we really wanted to make it more personal to them as city staff. And this, you know, intention to create an understanding was really around looking at what inequities actually exist. On my signature for work, I say my title really is Inequity Eliminator, because I want to eliminate inequities personally and professionally. And I'm sure that's a shared sentiment across the board for my colleagues who do this work. And to see inequities, we had to go through a process of visualization, mostly around what we need and what we want. And this is what we came up with. Everybody was sort of free to share what they felt, you know, when the question was around what does a desirable neighborhood look like or what does it have. And you can see some of the items that for you, you may not see, you may not want in a desirable neighborhood. One that stands out to me is gated. I don't find a gated neighborhood to be, or a community to be desirable for me, but that was the case for others. And they were then asked, you know, the question about, is there a single neighborhood in Des Moines that has all of these items that was collectively shared? And they said no. And so the next question was, do some neighborhoods in Des Moines have more of these than the others? And the answer was yes. So then the following question is where we really began to see, you know, how to visually look at inequities that are in our community. So the next question was, is it fair to say that most people want to live in a neighborhood that they desire to live in? Yes, right. And so what happens when government and other powerful institutions and structures systemically disallow that from happening, right? And so if I want to live in a neighborhood that has a built environment, I have a decent sized park, and it does not take a fire trucks to get there much longer than in a nicer, wealthier neighborhood, just because of the road conditions, for example. So that really brought it to our community. It personalized to a lot of the work that people in this team did, even folks that are, you know, directly don't work with the community. Such as our legal department. And so for them, the question then was, you know, can we undo that? Can we collectively work together to undo that? And what does that process look like? So 15 months later of creating a shared language and really understanding what equity means for us as City of Des Moines staff, you know, everybody was asked to bring one department-specific project, process, law, policy, or practice. They just wanted to test out, ask questions around, and really see if that project, policy, or practice was equitable. And some examples were shared. So this is actually what was in the email prior to our meeting. And they brought their project policies and practices, and we had a questionnaire that was really adopted from various sources, such as GARE, Racial Equity Tools, and other organizations that are centering and liberating the work of equity. And everybody had their either practice, project, or program, and just you know, walked through the questionnaire and asked these questions. And there were a total of 10 questions for them to really look at. And since you'll have the slide deck, you'll have an opportunity to look at it. It's still in draft one, but this is our way of creating a toolkit or a questionnaire for us to really look at as City of Des Moines employees, to sort of self-assess in a way, but to ensure that these questions will work moving forward if we are to modify, create new policies and practices. And just some pictures of a group discussion as members of our team sort of participated in, you know, answering these questions, and I'll share some of the responses that they came up with. So our fire department responded, the specific response, the first one is from our fire department around the question of how does the proposed action expand opportunity and access for individuals to city services to build trust? And they said offering alternative solutions with less expense, would result in less expense for the city. And the example here really was folks calling 911 for not knowing that for a medical emergency or medical situations that was not an emergency, where the fire truck or the EMT wouldn't have to show up, and if they were transported to the hospital and if it was not an emergency situation, they would be billed. Oftentimes, a lot of these community members would not be able to pay that make that payment. So then the dues were really on cities' shoulders, because if your residents aren't unable to make that payment, then oftentimes you forego that invoice. So in this case, it was actually costing city more for not informing our residents enough about when to call and how to make that call in a non-emergency situation. And then the second response was from our engineering department around how does the proposed action affect systemic change or address institutional inequities, and this was about sidewalk infill project that they were working on. And then two more responses just to share with you what was sort of the outcome of the conversation that we had. It was about giving all residents in the community a voice by diversifying our boards and commissions. And this is their response to the question of how does this action help to achieve greater equity? Describe the resources, timelines, and monitoring that will help ensure success. And I will tell you that as we were going through the questionnaire, some of the questions did not come off relevant to certain departments, and others felt that they needed to add more questions for the project or policy that they brought forth. And in that case, everybody was asked to just jot down additional questions that they thought of. And if there were non-relevant questions for the project that they brought or for the department, such as HR or even police department or civil and human rights, then they were just asked to make that note, so that at the end of the day, City of Des Moines would have its own questionnaire or equity toolkit to be utilized, but we would still cater it to each department and their needs and what's relevant to them. So that was really our process, and like you said, we're still in the process of finalizing. We want to make sure that we spend so much time in creating a shared language and creating our equity framework. We want to give it time so that there is an understanding across the board, especially among all of our 24 representatives from different departments, and also their colleagues in their departments, because City of Des Moines is 1,600 staff organization, and we want to make sure everybody across the board is using our equity toolkit. And with that, I will pass it on to my colleague, Amy.
Thank you so much, Manisha. I appreciate that. Hello, everyone. My name is Amy Kane, and I am the Equity Program Manager for the City of Boulder. I identify as a white cisgender woman, and my pronouns are she, her, and hers. Today, I am also presenting to you from Colorado. I am in Granby, Colorado today. And these are lands within the territories of the Ute, Cheyenne, and Arapaho. 48 contemporary tribal nations are historically tied to the lands that make up to the state of Colorado. It is such an honor to be here today, representing the work of my colleagues from the City of Boulder, that has really been guided by our colleagues in the GARE member network. We have been members of the GARE network since June of 2018 and have found the tools and resources provided can be right-sized to any organization depending on the needs of the community or the organization, similar to what Manisha was just talking about. We have found that because advancing racial equity is super complex and that progress is slow, defining a right tool is an iterative process, and we've benefited from experimenting what works with our organization and our community while finessing our work along the way. So today I want to briefly cover just what the City of Boulder refers to as a racial equity instrument, which is based on the GARE Racial Equity Toolkit. Our opportunity to streamline that instrument into the Rapid Response Racial Equity Assessment that has been assisting us with our COVID-19 response and recovery efforts, and then how we implemented the Rapid Response Racial Equity Assessment into our city's budgeting process. And then I want to give a little bit just about my perspective of the terminology, equity lenses, and then the pilot projects that we're lining up to more fully implement usage of the racial equity instrument in our upcoming council priority projects. So in 2019, we had a number of staff who attended what's known as the GARE member meeting in Albuquerque, New Mexico. At that particular member meeting, GARE was hosting two train the trainer modules for attendees. So one was how to use a racial equity tool, and the other was advancing racial equity, the role of government. We had five of our team members attend each of the sessions, and then the team who attended the tool training brought the work back to the city of Boulder. As we were talking to our leadership about the tool, we quickly realized that when in our organization, when we were calling it a tool, it led to a lot of confusion, particularly among some of our leadership. People were asking questions like, is it a computer program? Is it a hammer? Like, is it software? What is this? And so we just started very informally calling it a racial equity instrument, which is this six-step framework that you see here. And by calling it an instrument, it started resonating with colleagues in our organization. And we were able to also embed within our six-step process the City of Boulder's new community engagement framework, which the city had started to implement early in 2018. Our colleagues who attended that trainer session further refined the instrument, but also the training, so that it really resonated with our colleagues in our organization. They also worked with the workshop. We started to roll it out right around March of this year. And unfortunately, that was right when we all had to quarantine for the pandemic. So our team had to quickly pivot and create a virtual workshop for participants. And we've started to host the equity instrument training quarterly. We have advancing racial equity, the role of government, as a prerequisite for anybody who's attending. And we provide an opportunity for participants to bring a project to work on through the instrument. And then we have a consulting team who helps outside of the workshop itself to guide city staff on how to utilize the instrument appropriately. The picture you see here is some of our colleagues learning how to utilize the instrument. So in response to the pandemic and understanding historically that Black and our Latinx community members would suffer the greatest health disparities than what our white community members, we knew that in our response and recovery efforts, we really needed to ensure that we were focusing first and foremost on how to specifically support those community members who would be most impacted. We also knew we didn't have time to utilize our full-on racial equity instrument as we were making decisions around budget allocations, programs, any policy decisions, communication efforts that we were making. So as such, we based on the work that other GARE communities were doing, we created our own rapid response racial equity assessment and also put together a just-in-time training that we rolled out to various components of our organization, including our Boulder County Office of Emergency Management, who embedded this in their response to the pandemic. This was also the first year we asked similar questions in our 2020 budget reduction process and our 2021 request process. The rapid response racial equity assessment and the team of equity community connectors who we put together during this time period were really key to our engagement efforts with some of our most ignored communities. One successful story utilizing the rapid response racial equity assessment was around the face covering orders that the city adopted. Like many other communities, we immediately put into play a face mask, face covering ordinance or order, and communication was spotty. But we heard from our community connectors the impacts of the order, and we really listened to a solution that they brought, which was something we thought we could just go and distribute masks and people would just embrace them. Our equity connectors pitched an idea that we could, if they were allocated some funding, they were willing to purchase fabric. So some of the Latina community members could make and distribute masks from to their neighbors directly. So we were able to allocate some of our health equity fund dollars, reallocate those to purchasing fabric for those Latinas, and it was hugely successful. It's been really interesting as staff across the organization started hearing about the rapid response racial equity assessment. They immediately started utilizing it as they would a racial equity instrument. But as they started working through the assessment, they started noticing the gaps between the instrument versus the assessment. And so the instrument is just more of a robust, longer-term opportunity when you're making decisions. So we had membership or participant registrations for our instrument training went up considerably just with us putting out the rapid response racial equity assessment. So as I mentioned before, this was the first year that we implemented the rapid response racial equity assessment into our budgeting process, and we had incredibly mixed results. This is the first time we tried to put an equity focus on our budgeting. And so we figured these very simple questions from the rapid response assessment would be a great place to start. And so we utilized it in decision-making for staff furloughs, as well as our 2020 budget cuts, and then also as we were preparing for our 2021 requests and cuts. Like I said before, we had very mixed results. Some departments really understood it and made some decisions accordingly. Others was a real check-the-box kind of exercise for them. But it really gave us, as a team, good information as to where we need to better support staff in training and how to utilize the tool. It was helpful for staff and leadership to understand which staff would be most impacted due to furloughs and layoffs. It was also really helpful in evaluating, one example was our tuition reimbursement policy. Our human resources department was on the fence about what they wanted to do about the reimbursement policy, and did decide in the end to put the program on hold. As we were having the conversation and working through the assessment, what they realized is that the higher level staff and higher paid employees were the ones who were utilizing the reimbursement policy, usually to attend grad school or higher level education. In talking with our HR director at the time, I pointed out the fact that this was a reimbursement policy rather than funding in advance. It could be the reason that there's such a disparate impact of who's really utilizing that funding. So for now, the tuition reimbursement program is on hold because we've had such budget impacts due to the COVID pandemic. But HR is determined to evaluate the policy utilizing the racial equity instrument moving forward in 2020. I think what we've found, I know that what we've found, is one of the greatest weaknesses for all of our tools has been in access to data. We currently have a very decentralized process for collecting data and analyzing data, which we're working to address with the creation of a data warehouse. But you can also see that, like with the rapid response racial equity assessment, we're asking questions that really provide qualitative data. So I've been working with our innovation and technology department to put together some type of process so we can convert the qualitative data into quantitative data. We don't let those data challenges keep us from continuing the forward momentum, but I think what we also learned through the budgeting process is we need a better dashboard so we can compare the cuts across the organization to understand how pulling each different lever really impacts another department. We really found that this process was an important opportunity to help educate staff and to work with the departments to transform the data that we need. With all of our city staff, we continue to encourage collaboration in this work, and we say repeatedly that there's a need for consulting with staff and community who have different backgrounds, perspectives, and experience, but we still find we have many individuals who think this is a check-the-box exercise. Over time, we are seeing more and more staff start to understand and reach out to our team members for support. But this is an ongoing, continuous process, and you have to try as an equity leader or as a any staff member who's doing this work to always bring that conversation alive in every room that you're in. I often joke that my superpower is rust, and that I just keep bringing it up in every space, and it does, the momentum works. So lastly, I want to talk a little bit about the role leadership plays in advancing racial equity within our organization. So early on, I created a guiding coalition for our racial equity work, which currently includes 5 council members, as well as our city manager, our deputy city manager, director of our human resources and our housing and human services department, as well as our police chief. I was noticing also that there's been a trend in community and council utilizing the term equity and equity lens to such a level that it's really starting to lose its meaning. So I've had to start coaching team members and the leadership to start talking about how you need to have an equity focus. I talk a lot to them about how lenses can be removed, but when you have a focus on something, you're really drilling down and being incredibly intentional in every decision that you make. We've also chose some upcoming opportunities for team members to specifically utilize the racial equity instrument and present to council how it's going to be used in 2020 remaining opportunities, and then also in 2021 opportunities that you see on this slide. We specifically chose these because they're at various phases in their development. Some of these projects are at the very beginning phase, which we always say that's the best time to start utilizing a racial equity instrument. But we also want to see what happens when it comes along midway through a process. And we want to bring this back to council and be very explicit of how the instrument has been utilized and how it has guided or impacted the work moving forward. Another challenge that I've recently started working on is asking our council retreat subcommittee before they have their retreat in January for the 2021 process, their work planning process. I've asked that we utilize the racial equity instrument in the prioritization of the council work plan items. So that's still at the very infancy stages. I'm not exactly sure how it will go or how it will work, but I think it'd be a fun exercise to help council members get on board to understand even further how racial equity is such an important element of the decisions that we make, even though the city of Boulder itself is a pretty white dominant culture. So I think that what happens sometimes in advancing our racial equity work is that we've really built into our systems a need for perfection, and that really holds us back. So it's important that no matter the size of your budget or your organization, that you start small and pilot some opportunities. Call them pilots. Assess your results and find out what works. I feel like we learn the most when we make our mistakes, and it's about, you know, admitting that there was a mistake, but really learning from it and acknowledging what you've learned and then pivoting and moving forward. So with that, I would like to turn it over to my colleague, Siri Russell from Albemarle County, Virginia. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and happy Tuesday to everyone who's with us today. I'm going to talk a little bit differently than some of my peers, and I have to admit I'm a little disappointed it's my turn because I wasn't finished jotting down notes. Some really great stuff being shared this afternoon. So what I'm going to share a little bit is how Albemarle County has been working on putting the tools together. So first I'll do that thing where, you know, I introduce myself. I'm Siri Russell. I'm a mother. I like to describe myself as a failed yogi, someone who has attempted yoga a couple of times and haven't been able to make it work. A self-care enthusiast. I think that folks who do the type of work that we do, and folks who are in local government, especially that requires the really high level of transparency and responsiveness to community members, really have to prioritize self-care when you can. Mine is romance novels, so if anyone's looking for a good recommendation, I'm happy to share. I also like to describe myself as a thought partner. Often in this work of equity and inclusion, you know, we are called to just sort of immediately brainstorm with folks on ways to address inequities in some fields that I have very little exposure to. So in those instances, I like to describe myself as a thought partner coming in. And then finally, a wannabe Power Ranger. So I don't know if there are any 90s kids in here or folks who just enjoy superheroes, but I'm a big fan of teamwork. And the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers I often use as an example of excellent teamwork and of getting things accomplished together with everyone sort of owning their role. I am representing Albemarle County, Virginia. Just a little bit about us, since you all have the internet, you also have Google and can look that up yourself if you're interested. But we're a mid-sized county. Something that I think is unique about us is that we are both urban and rural. Our population is about 45% in the rural area and about 55% in the urban area. So we exist almost as two communities in a way, and that really requires some careful perspective and different outlook, especially as it relates to equity. And I bring that up and call that out just in case there are other localities with a similar experience or other rural localities listening today who might be interested in doing this work. The most important thing that I will share with you is that Albemarle County, Virginia, we are on our growing edge, which I really describe as being right up on the precipice of what we're able to do and a wide, dark gulf of fear and uncertainty, right, which is uncomfortable but is full of possibility. And so for us right now, we're really leaning into that edge and leaning into our mission, which I want to share with you guys because I think it's really relevant to this conversation and to other local governments. Our mission statement is to enhance the well-being and quality of life for all. Right now it says citizens, but we are looking to change that to residents through the provision of the highest level of public service consistent with the prudent use of public funds. This has been a really sort of centering place for us in conversations around the why of equity in our work. That all being the really sort of driving emphasis here is that our mission is to enhance well-being and quality of life for all. And it may be similar for you guys in that I think we are very good at doing what's going to help the most for the most reasonable amount of money, right? To really spread it out in a way that we're catching as many folks as we can for as cheap as possible, so, you know, not to put too fine a point on it. But where I think we have struggled in the past is that when you lean on catching the most, you tend to be catching the same folks in that group. And so you end up not catching, not resourcing, not investing in the same groups over and over. And so for us, this work of equity and the work of developing equity tools is really an attempt to fully live our mission and to really address the all of our mission statement. And I hope that resonates with some of the folks who are listening, because I think that's something that local governments share. The other thing I wanted to say just real briefly, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, is that for us, that all part also includes diversity and inclusion. And I know we're talking about equity today, but I did want to just take a moment when we talk about Albemarle County's work, is that we really are trying to acknowledge the distinctions between these three different things, the different types of work that it takes, and devote our resources and attention to all three. So I titled this slide Throwing Hands, mostly because I thought it was funny, but also because I thought that one of the things that was really important for us, I mentioned we're on our growing edge, so we're in the beginning stages, right, is the hands part, the hands that hold the tools. We understand that our best tools are humans in our organization, who up until the past couple of years have not really been equipped to wield tools of equity, to understand or engage in those sort of conversations. And so we really started from a place of trying to increase our capacity to actually hold and use tools that further equity. And so we've done that in a variety of ways, by formalizing our commitment, so really putting down deliberately and with specificity what it is that we are attempting to do around equity, by building relationships both internally and externally, by increasing organizational capacity through trainings and then also through public affirmation. So not just an internal specific commitment, but also voicing that commitment publicly and continuing to reaffirm that commitment publicly, both in action and in word. So we've done some things that have been, I think, quite exciting that have helped move us along this path. But when we really started digging in, right, after we did all the talking about affirming, after we did the, you know, the trainings, after we, you know, built relationships and really broadcasted our intentions, we sort of immediately ran into what I describe as things that don't make your equity dreams come true. Roadblocks, which I think some of my fellow panelists have talked about as well, quite a bit of them. So right off the bat, when we started talking about how we were going to actually assess the impacts of our policies, of our procedures, of our processes, of our systems for equity, we did what we usually did, right? We'll do what we always do, which is look for benchmarks. And we looked at our benchmarking localities, the localities that were very similar to us, both in region and size and in many other ways, were not similar to us in attempting to address equity. In fact, we found that we, in our list of benchmark communities, were the only ones who were on this journey. We also ran into issues around manual processes. So I don't know about you guys, but we have quite a few of those in our county. An example that I would give you with that would be our chart of accounts. We have over 50,000 codes, and it's been recently talked about how all these different, how the best practices for that is somewhere closer to 5,000. So when I started asking questions about, hey, how can we find out, you know, where we're investing public money, right, and looking at that across our locality, the answers were, well, I could get you that answer, but I would have to do A, B, C, D, and it would take, you know, weeks of time, basically, in order for us to arrive at a conclusion. A roadblock. We also, much like Amy, struggled with inconsistency in our data. Across our departments, we were not capturing data the same way. We weren't capturing the same kinds of data, and we had limited staff resources to address it. We don't have staff members devoted to things like demographic analysis or performance management. So those were really things that made our first entry into attempting to develop an equity tool quite difficult. But we didn't, much like Amy said, we didn't stop with that. And I want to share what we tried to do to address those with the group, because it might be useful for others, other localities with limited resources. So one of the first things we did was say, okay, we're going to scrap our benchmark localities and instead turn to aspirational localities. So we looked instead at localities that were of a similar size but had tried something, whether it was an equity program or whether it was it wasn't necessarily equity impact assessments, but they tried programs, they had language, And those were the groups that instead we tried to start connecting with. We also looked to start walking with the willing. I think that most folks can probably relate to the fact that not every department head, not every staff person is at the exact same place when it comes to the level of commitment. But as we look to develop our tool, which I'll show you here in a moment, we prioritize walking the furthest with the folks who were most willing to put their feet to the ground. We also decided to just manage our expectations when it came to the data analysis work. We said, let's figure out what we can do right now that's reasonable and that we can do consistently, and we'll continue to build from there. And then the next thing that we did to address the fact that we were lacking in some staff capacity was phone a friend. We reached out to partners in our locality, other communities, and especially to some of our key community partners like the University of Virginia, which happens to be where we're located. And so that brought us to being in a position to actually launch a pilot assessment tool, which is what we have been doing now. It is it's been created in partnership with the University of Virginia's Equity Center and their School of Architecture. We are taking right now a land use emphasis. And the reasoning for that is, one, because they were willing, as I alluded to before, but also because we understand land use as really being a guide for how we shape our community, and a guide for understanding how we distribute sort of benefits and burdens, as well as a tool for increasing accessibility to both resource and opportunity. So, and we did this with a focus on what we can answer right now and continue to build for the future sort of emphasis. So I wanted to take a moment just to sort of show you briefly, and I'll put this is freely available, so I'll put a link in the chat so that folks can look at this themselves, but to show you what we did. So we, just like my colleagues, were looking to be able to answer questions about who, what, and where, who was being impacted, where they were being impacted, how they were being impacted, and to better understand the landscape of equity in our community. We needed to be able to look at a variety of indicators, and we needed to be able to do it both in space and in an actual place and consistently. And so our partners with the University of Virginia worked collaboratively with us to create this equity atlas. We like to call it a decision support tool, but essentially it has our county and our other regional partners in this tool spatially, where we're able to choose indicators by categories that that you would not be surprised by, things like youth and education, housing, health, jobs, wages, income, and look at that through lenses of race, of age, of gender, income, and also look at it by year. And so I want to give just a quick example of how we've used this to help sort of target opportunities for investment or to increase accessibility. And so what you see here is just blank, you know, page starting out. It's just the things that's the shape of Albemarle County, and then it's got census tracts that right now are you're seeing the darkened colors based on population. What we have here is a look at the percentage of children living in poverty in a census tract. So the darker the color, the higher the concentration or percentage of children living in poverty. And then what we've highlighted are county parks. So Albemarle County Parks, which we see as a public good, a free resource for our community members, and especially targeting children, are highlighted in green. You can probably see that the dark blue indicating the highest concentrations of children in poverty are not necessarily lined up with that resource, with these parks. So this was not surprising to us when we first saw it. And in fact, because the city of Charlottesville is actually inside Albemarle County, it's sort of often been thought, well, children who live closer in that way, who are near the city of Charlottesville, actually have access to city parks. So we're all good. But what we were able to do with this tool was then also look at city parks. And so that's what those little blobs of dark green that have popped up in the middle are. And what we found, and you can probably see this, and I don't have a little pointer, but you can probably see this there, that sort of finger of darker blue coming out the top of the city, is we found, wow, it is true that children do have in the urban ring do have access to city parks. But what we are also able to see is that the areas where we have children who are most in need of access to this resource are actually still not able to access it. So we were able to identify a gap in our services, and also in the way that we have been thinking about accessibility to some of our services. And I would note that through the use of this tool and through the work that's gone into actually developing it, we were also able to demonstrate that some of these areas, and I won't point it out, that also have this, that also have children living in higher concentrations of poverty, are also areas where we have our lowest life expectancy, where we have higher levels of zoning enforcement and other types of enforcement, and a variety of other things. So it's really caused us to think a little more critically in some areas about some of the things that we thought that we knew. And it wouldn't have been possible without partnership, is what I would stress there. So I want to make sure that we have plenty of time for questions, so I'm not going to go super deep into that. But what I'll end on an invitation, and that is to stay connected. I have found that the most thoughtful and most generous folks with their time that I have met in local government have been folks who are trying to do this work and who are trying to affect change. So I would invite anyone who is interested in learning more about the work that we're doing or the tool that we're developing, to please feel free to reach out, even if it's just to chat about Power Rangers or romance novels. And at that, I guess I'll shut up because I think it's time for Q&A.
Thank you so much to all of our speakers. Just a note before we do head into Q&A, that the recording of the session will be available shortly after it ends, so you will get access to that. Just another reminder, if you have any questions, go ahead and type those in now into the chat box, and be sure to click the send button. So we've had many questions come in. So this would be one that any of you could jump in on here, asking, how can local governments engage marginalized communities in these racial equity conversations without unduly placing the burden on these communities for educating their white colleagues?
This is Amy. I'm happy to chime in just a little bit about what we've done at the city. When we were putting out our call out for our first racial equity core team, we were very cognizant to just put it out as a blanket opportunity and made very clear what the ask was. And so for that very first equity core team that we put together in 2018, we had 60 city staff from across the organization sign up to participate in that work. And then many of those individuals have continued on. And we found that individuals who want to participate in this work, who are our colleagues of color, the ones who have wanted to do the work are passionate about not feeling like it is up to them to educate their white colleagues, but they feel like they want to bring them along and want to mix up the voices in the team. We have had put some processes in place. We've created a couple of caucuses for our racial equity core team members. So our communities, our colleagues of color can be in one caucus while the white colleagues of color are in another caucus, just to help support our colleagues of color. And then with regard to facilitators, it's really if folks want to be facilitators in this space, then we ask for the participation. But we do sometimes get questions from our staff or our employees asking why are there two white people who are presenting this information, and we speak specifically that we feel like we do not need to put this burden on our colleagues of color, that it's up to us as white people to have these conversations as well. I hope that answers your question, Nicole.
Great, thank you. Have any of you had any issues navigating with Trump's executive order regarding trainings?
Hey, this is Roberto. I'm happy to kind of talk through some of this because, you know, the Trump administration essentially wants to prevent people from talking and working together to overcome racism and inequality, you know, by calling this type of work, right? And it's not just training, right? We're in the business of humanity development. We're developing our humanity for a more just society. But calling that un-American divisive propaganda essentially to me validates that we are doing the right work, that there is a coalition, as I mentioned, and that there is a collection and a consensus that is building across the country that is addressing racism and inequality. And so what I think we do is we need to lean into it. So we're not navigating it. We're confronting that type of a very flimsy argument to say that if you talk about institutional and historic racism, then in fact, you are indeed the racist. And it is a very, very interesting way of gaslighting people in terms of why we're trying to do this work. But the extreme hardships that we're experiencing, there is a collective of local governments, organizations, and leaders from all industries, like from sports to the arts, to business, to philanthropy, who are all stepping up in this moment to defend a path to greater equity and understanding. And so my advice to anyone in this is to lean in, even the city of Seattle, who's experiencing the brunt of this, the Department of Justice, who was actually investigating them. They're encouraging us to lean into this work and to speak to the necessity of the work. As I mentioned earlier, you simply cannot wish away racism. And if the argument is that it's un-American to talk about racism, then what we're saying is that racism is so embedded within our institutions that we can't talk about it without being un-American. And that just doesn't, in our minds, it doesn't work, and it doesn't meet what we're seeing. And we're seeing institutions, jurisdictions, and leaders across the country who acknowledge the pervasiveness of inequity and who are willing to do that work. So that would be my recommendation.
Great, thank you so much.
I'm sorry, it's Mary. Before we move on, I just wanted to just briefly go back to the first question, and I just wanted to add on. I thought that was a good one. I would say for Albemarle County that we have invested heavily in our white staff, sort of equity leaders, and that we have a 10-month-long racial equity training that that folks have opted into. We've had about 135 members of staff choose to participate with the goal of really arming folks to be qualified and confident advocates for the work that we're doing. So I just wanted to say that as well.
Great, thank you. For any of our panelists, have you brought in outside facilitators to discuss race equity while developing your common language or creating your toolkit?
This is Manisha. I can answer that. We have not. So my position was created as equity coordinator, and I came on board in October 2017. We've had GARE, we're a member of GARE, so we've had two GARE staff come and do a GARE 101 understanding, you know, roles, government's role in racial equity, one-day session with the city staff, but for the most part, it's been internal conversations, and that's one of the reasons why it's taken longer. We've gone back and forth between hiring an outside entity, because sometimes city staff may listen well, but some have also indicated that, you know, when you have an outside facilitator come and have these conversations, you believe that they don't have the context of your organization, so some staff may not fully sort of participate in the conversation for creating a shared language. So we opted with internal conversation and internal facilitation. And so in our team, though, I do the primary facilitation of the conversations, but ensure that other team members also come up with questions in advance so that everybody feels like they're a part of the bigger conversation.
Can I add on to that one? This is Amy. We also had a couple of GARE facilitators with our initial core team come and host those conversations, but that is why we did the train the trainer modules that GARE was offering at their member meeting, is so we could ensure that we had a sustainable network of trained staff facilitators who could help do this work. We've also recently started doing bias and microaggression training, and we have an outside facilitation team that is put together a workshop for our internal organization, but it has a train the trainer facilitation component built into it to get back to that sustainability point. What we found is it's really challenging if you just bring in consultants to come in and do the training, because it's oftentimes like a one and done, whereas if you build staff capacity, like Manisha was talking about, for others to be able to have the conversations, normalize it, then you have a more robust long-term sustainability opportunity. So like we host Advancing Racial Equity Role of Government for all of our new employees who come into the organization. And it's mandatory for all of our city supervisors. So I think at the outset, it can be very helpful, but when you're really looking at long-term sustainability, the more you can empower your colleagues to help with the work, I think that it creates a little bit more buy-in and long-term opportunity to keep the knowledge going.
Great, thank you. So is it better to move forward with a racial equity initiative without necessarily assessing organization-wide buy-in first? Or should we wait and make sure that there is broad support before implementation?
So I'm happy to answer a bit of this question. This is Roberto again. And, you know, this is, you know, what a lot of folks say, it depends, right? I think that having an equity kind of survey to get a sense of where you're at is always a great thing. And I've worked with organizations that we've been able to do that. But I've also worked in organizations where some of the panelists talked about you have to just pilot some things to create some momentum. And then that would help hopefully build broader support and maybe senior leadership support. And so sometimes it depends. If you have the ability, the resources, and can do some sort of equity scan, I would highly recommend doing that so that you have a sense of where the opportunities are. But you have to be very mindful in terms of what questions are that you're asking. As part of GARE membership, you do have access to an equity assessment done through our research team and Dr. Raintree Salk, who works with the Government Alliance on Race and Equity. But again, I think it does depend on your organization, it depends on where you're at, and it depends on what type of momentum that you're trying to build. And so I'd open it up to some of the other panelists who've probably, you know, done some of this work.
Yeah, I am. This is Siri here. One thing that I think that's a great question. Something that we did a couple of years ago in our employee engagement survey was ask folks to attest to how sincerely they felt the organization was committed to diversity, equity, and inclusivity. And the results from that were not all that positive. Almost 40% of staff said that they did not think the organization was committed to that. to those values, and over 50% of employees of color indicated that they were not, that they did not believe the organization was committed to that. And so that's really been a rallying cry for us, but it's also been a, I think, something that really points to the fact, too, that there's the folks who are not willing to do things because they don't believe in diversity, equity, and inclusion, and then there are the folks who just don't believe in you and who just don't believe that the organization is really a good partner. And so I think to Robert's point when he says, you know, it depends, I think it's also important to consider, you know, which one of those factors you're dealing with when you're considering what your next moves are.
And that's a perfect segue into this next question, asking, you know, when you're implementing your equity tools and instruments, how do you overcome those who just don't see the need or value of equity in the workplace, especially those in senior positions?
So this is Amy. I think when you start, you start as this is the way it is. Like, we are going to focus on this work, and when you adopt it at the level of leadership that we've adopted it at least, you will have people who say that they don't think it has anything to do with their work, but when you're really approaching it from this is government's responsibility, it makes it definitely easier for folks to understand. I think you have to hold staff accountable too. We haven't quite gotten to the level that we're incorporating it to our performance evaluations. But it's also, this is the value of our organization. And if you're not into it, there's another organization down the road that perhaps your personal values align with better. But as an organization, this is who we are and this is how we're operating. I think it also comes from a little bit of what I think Siri was talking about from the relationship aspect. You really have to build relationships with people and listen and learn to understand what their real challenges are in overcoming the work, to help align the work and the language such that they will understand it and see the value of it. Because most people understand as government leaders that we are here to help support our communities and in service to our communities. So it makes sense to do this work in order to support that.
And if I may, this is Manisha. Just to add to that, it was a common experience that I've had. It has been a common experience that I've had with why are we doing this? And oftentimes there is so much beauty in unpacking where people are coming from. And you know, the end goal really is it's not about you, right? Like, it's not about that one individual who may be resistant to this or who may have biases, explicit or implicit. Or have had a set of beliefs that have resulted in them thinking the way they are. So making it about just that example of the desirable neighborhood that I shared, you know, it is about the ultimate goal is for us to have a community, a city, a county, a state where we all thrive. And how do we all benefit when everybody benefits and every single aspect of our community benefits and every single resident benefits. So ensuring that this is bigger than them as an individual always has helped, whether it's the electeds or senior staff. And also, one of the things that we did here in Des Moines was the members of our equitable services team, you know, everyone had to either be a manager or department director or be in a position of making decisions, whatever that is, whether it's their HR decisions or other budgetary decisions within their department, also to ensure that majority of them are white, and if they're not, they're still in positions where they can have an influence. You know, it's great to have our staff of color be a part of this, but at the end of the day, someone in their department will have to make decisions, and oftentimes we want them to be a part of the conversation where we're unpacking the resistance that they may have, whether expressed or not.
those organizations that are in the process of creating or have recently created a diversity and inclusion position, do you have any recommendations as far as the first steps for the person in that position to take during that first year and where to get resources?
Find your allies. Sorry, this is Manisha again. Find your allies in your organization, in your department. If you're a department of one person, find your allies in the community. That building relationship in the community is going to be your, you know, this whoever's in this position's biggest strength, because DEI, equity, racial equity is really seen as this side, right? It's the side dish. But you're really that salt in a savory dish. You're the main, you're part of the main dish of everything, and the side dish. So, and for that, that building allyship within the community, because being in a new role, even if you're a member of the community right now, it's going to be different. And finding allies, meaning people that can hold your back and be a part of that shared language within the organization, which is going back to Siri's point about building relationship, going out for coffees, and I'm 3 years late in creating an equity plan for the city of Des Moines, but that just has to be a part of the process, and one thing I often say is this is intentional, this is part of the process, and it's worked so far.
Can I add something to that? This is Roberto, and I wanted to, you know, because Manisha is in that position now, I wanted to allow for her to articulate, you know, a real lived experience, and I've been in that role before, and one of the things that I learned quickly was that it's a wonderful position to have, and it's also a very difficult position to be in, because sometimes it creates the idea that that one person is responsible for diversity, equity, and inclusion, and that narrative has to be reframed, that it is everyone's responsibility, that it cannot fall to one person or to one department or one group to do it. Similar to the budgeting process, all of us submit budgets, and all of us hold ourselves accountable to them, and sometimes we forecast. But equity, it's the same way. All of us need to do this work. We all need to be held accountable to it, and we can't opt out of it. You can't just say, you know what, I'm not submitting a budget this year. Like, no, you have to. In the same way, we have to think about what are the ways that we are promoting, mitigating, and hopefully advancing equity. And so those roles and those positions are really important, but it's also very important to think about and to create a strategic plan of where that position is located. The higher up it is located, the more ability that position is going to have to effectuate lasting, meaningful, institutional, structural, and policy changes. And so start thinking about those things, and it needs to be resourced. A lot of times we put together committees of folks who work in different areas who have different jobs, and that's a great strategy. But without resources, it becomes very difficult to do that work, resources in terms of time, talent, and treasure. So that would be my recommendation.
In your locales, do the elected officials participate in the training, and do they use the toolkit in decision-making processes?
So this is Amy. We, yes. Advancing Racial Equity, the Role of Government, we host for all of our council members. Some of the council members want to make it a mandatory training for all of our council members, as well as our boards and commissions. But it's really challenging. Staff can't mandate that council takes a training. However, they've peer pressured each other for the most part to where 8 out of 9 of our council members have taken Advancing Racial Equity, the Role of Government, as part of their onboarding process, and also just because they believe in the work. The instrument training, I need to do better about giving them the opportunity to participate in those, but that is why we are doing the strategy of having our guiding coalition knows what the instrument is, but we are having those pilot projects go before council, very specifically articulating how the instrument was utilized and what the impacts were.
And just real quick, because we are at the end, are there any GARE trainings available to everyone and anyone?
Generally, our trainings are available to members. We are rolling out a new training called GARE Foundations that's going to be available monthly as part of membership. So I'd encourage just inquiring into membership to have access to those to those trainings. And then go to Race Forward as well, where we have trainings that are available to the larger, to the public writ large.
Great. Thank you so much to all of our presenters and to all of our participants who joined us today. Tons of great questions that came in. Before you leave us, please do take a moment to fill out a brief survey about the program. Click that evaluation link in the links box on the left side of your screen. We would love to get your comments and suggestions. The survey must be completed in order to receive a certificate for this program, FYI. You can also access the survey from your ICMA University dashboard by clicking on the program title once you're logged in. We hope you'll all join us again soon. Today's program is copyright 2020 by the International City County Management Association, with all rights reserved. This does conclude the program. Have a wonderful day, and you may now disconnect.